It is 11:05. Happy Wednesday. The Institute of Marriage and Family Canada is out with a study on the marriage gap between rich and poor Canadians. And I never really thought about it in those terms, but how Canadians are split into haves and have-nots that also line up with marriage lines. It's about the first, well, it is the first ever analysis of StatsCan data that really examines the link between marriage and income. Marriage and income. I have said this many times, and I will go to my grave saying this. My wife makes enough money that I get to stay in radio. Peter John Mitchell joins us, Senior Researcher, Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. How you been?
Good, thanks, Gary.
So I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. Income is important, obviously. I think it's a factor in I suppose anybody's level of contentedness. But is it that high of a priority? Is it that high up the pecking list to keep marriages solvent? Money?
You know, I don't think that Canadians naturally think about money when they think about marriage. They probably think about it as a destination within a relationship, a sign of commitment and coming together. So I'm not suggesting that Canadians need to get married to better their income standing or to primarily think about marriage in income terms. But I think the point of our release yesterday was to help think through how income and marriage are related, particularly in bigger understandings of and the bigger discussions about income inequality and those kinds of issues as well. And we're sort of hoping that we put the data points out there and that people of different policy stripes and different sort of sectors look at it and get a discussion going.
But it is a factor. The stats bear it out that it is a factor.
Yeah, I mean, certainly marriage isn't a silver bullet for social problems, but it has been connected to family stability, economic well-being. On average, married families build more wealth, helps protect against poverty, less likely to miss rent payments and other sort of effects of poverty. So there is certainly some protective factors and some economic factors to marriage. And just, I mean, some of it's obvious, the ability to pool income, ability to share and paid and unpaid labor. There's some of those advantages to navigating the life course and being able to have a little give and take between two incomes if possible. So
what happened when marriages started to decline?
Well, it's really interesting. We looked at a 35-year period, and we basically divided Canadians through StatsCan data into the highest 25% of income-earning families and individuals and the bottom 25%, and then we combined that two middle quartiles and made them sort of one sort of economic level for us to be able to kind of look at the numbers. And so we looked at marriage and common law together because that's what the data allowed. Didn't allow us to separate it until much later in the data set, so not until 1987. But basically the findings are this. The share of married families has always been high in that top 25%, and it's remained pretty much very stable over a 35-year period. But among middle-income earners and lower-income earners, that share of marriage has dropped over time.
Does marriage create wealth?
The causation effect is a great question, and it's one we don't address in the paper just because our data doesn't allow for it. So there is this kind of debate, and I think there's evidence on both sides that there are those protective factors for marriage against, you know, having the two incomes, or there's been data that suggests that married men make more than single men. So there's some of those data points that would suggest that coming together does allow for asset building, income pooling, those types of things. On the other side, there's also some evidence of what we may call assortative mating, so that people that perhaps seek higher education, post-secondary education, and have sort of, I guess, potential for higher incomes tend to find each other, meet and marry, and that might explain why there's been so much stability in the marriage rate or marriage share across that top 25%, although our study can't tell us that for sure. So,
okay, so it's a bit of some of the things that I wanted to point out here, according to your study, in the year 2011, 86% of high-income families included a married couple, but only 12% of low-income families included a married couple. So what can we make the assumption of based on those two numbers?
Yeah, I mean, that's a significant difference. And also with that low-income number, that number is pretty much in 1976 was 25%, and it's dropped more than half now, down to 12%. So that's a pretty severe decline that we've noticed. And so that gap has really grown over time. One of the interesting and surprising things that we found, however, though, is in the last 13 years, the marriage decline has begun to show signs of steadying out and becoming a little more stable. And in fact, we saw small increases in a marriage share among certain age groups within the low-income and middle-income earners. So that's been something interesting to look at, and I'm not sure why that is, but it's something that I'd like to investigate a little bit further.
I just find it kind of fascinating, and you know, I'm coming at it from a guy that, you know, my wife and I have been together for over 30 years, so I'm coming at it from a different perspective. This is really the only reality I've known for so long. I can't remember what it was like to be single.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly, talking to somebody yesterday about the project, and they're saying, I can't afford not to be married at this point. Like, we've just lived so long together, combining assets and learning how to work out economic issues in our marriage and in our family together, that it's hard to imagine, not having that. And of course, particularly, we see this kind of growing trend towards what they call it sometimes the gray divorce, or as my father would say, it's silver divorce, where older couples are divorcing. And obviously that's financially devastating when you're dividing assets that have been accumulated over years and years, right? And so we certainly see the opposite of effect of that and how devastating that is when that does happen, unfortunately.
So what can we learn from that? I don't want everybody to run out today and buy a marriage license. I don't think that if you want to improve your income, you have to find somebody who's going to say I do. I don't think that's the message here.
No, that's definitely not the message. And hopefully, people aren't trying to marry for money. That would be not a good idea, I don't think. I primarily see this as a larger social structural issue, and that's the way that we've tried to approach it. Rather than looking at it as a personal marriage issue, rather than saying to Canadians, oh, you better run out and get married, we're kind of looking at the bigger social structure issue. I think if we give, if we look at data and we, Canadians are aware of what the study says, they're aware of, what the possible outcomes are of the decisions that they make in life, and there's no guarantees. I trust Canadians to make their own decisions about what's best for their own life. So I think this is really maybe getting the conversation started among maybe policymakers, although I don't think this is really a government problem. I think it's a cultural issue. But there might be things that government can do to lower economic burdens for people who already aspire to get married, because we know that sometimes economic barriers prevent young people from entering into different life stages. And so that may be part of it. Maybe part of it for the businesses to recognize that married families, especially with kids, spend a lot of money. They're a big consumer force, so it might behoove them to make sure that their advertising about marriage and about family is positive. And also, what role do community groups have in this as well in terms of helping couples that are married? Is there a role there for charitable groups to offer financial education, marriage education, or some kind of support? So I think to those sectors, maybe there's some thinking they're doing, and I think Canadians can make their own decisions about their private lives.
That's pretty radical. to suggest that we get to make choices about our own life and not have to go to the government to get direction from it, especially for the last how long we've heard that Ontario in particular has become a nanny state. Now you're saying we get to make decisions? Wow.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not recommending a national strategy for matchmaking. I think that would be a disaster.
Part of Canada's economic action plan.
That's right.
I can see the commercials now. Peter, always good to get you on the show. Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, bye-bye. Peter John Mitchell.